to Roswell and said,
welcome, everyone, to A Global Focus. Tonight's program features author Preston Dennett, MUFON field investigator, ufologist, ghost hunter, and paranormal researcher and pioneer. Good evening. This is Reese Sheridan, host of A Global Focus. Tonight's guest is Preston Dennett. The show is broadcast live on the International Paranormal Radio Network with its anchor station UPRN 105.7 FM New Orleans. Other listening venues include U.S. Stream TV, Awcast, Live 365 and Shoutcast, and via mobile phone by dialing 704-631-4060 and entering the four-digit station ID code number 2899. Thank you to Joe Montaldo, owner of the Paranormal Radio Network, for making these broadcasts possible. Preston Dennett has authored 10 books and more than 100 articles on ufology and the paranormal. Preston has appeared as guest speaker on numerous TV and radio programs. He is a MUFON field investigator, ufologist, ghost hunter, paranormal researcher, and pioneer in lucid dreaming and out-of-body exploration. Preston's research has been presented in the Dallas Morning News, the LA Times, and the LA Daily News. His articles have been published in Nexus, Fate, the MUFON UFO Journal, Atlantis Rising, the Paranormal Magazine, the UFO Magazine, the Ufologist, and other publications. Preston, welcome. Your research has been recognized in print and media, and your findings entail a wide spectrum of ufology and paranormal fields. I'm thrilled you're my guest this evening.
Well, thank you. I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you very much.
Well, you know, Preston, I can't wait to hear your comments on current developments that most intrigue you and past cases that strongly impressed you. The topic points tonight are open from ufology and ET research to ghost hunting and lucid dreaming and out-of-body exploration. And here to your admiring audience, those very bright people in our UPRN virtual auditorium, our chat room, please, discussion is open. Name your questions. Preston's research is extremely extensive and detailed. This is a great person to whom to direct your questions. Now, Preston, where would you like to start tonight? we have got ufology and ET study interests. Oh, let me ask a quick question. This is my favorite topic. Preston, your research on sightings over the Pacific coast, including the shoreline, deep water, and Catalina Island, always seems to produce new details. Have there been further sightings of USOs emerging from the Pacific near the California coast?
I haven't heard of a whole lot of recent cases, but I'm still getting a lot of, information appearing on the History Channel on deep-sea UFOs and UFO hunters. I've been getting a ton of information. And I have to tell you, the coast off of Southern California here has got to be one of the most active areas for underwater UFO activity. I know, like, Gulf Breeze is active in underwater UFOs, and Puerto Rico, and areas around Iceland, I have heard. I don't have any first-hand cases, but right around here on where I am, off the coast of Los Angeles, Malibu, Topanga Canyon, Pacific Palisades, basically the Santa Catalina Channel. I'm estimating I've got about 100 cases of underwater UFO activity. I'm not including the cases where people are seeing UFOs flying above the water, but these are cases where UFOs are coming right down, floating on the water, or diving into the water, or coming up out of the water. So I've got enough information for a book, really. That's going to be one of my future books, definitely.
Well, you know, those unidentified submerged objects are really fascinating. And, you know, Preston, I can remember seeing you on one of the major programs, I think it was History Channel, discussing your research there with the sightings over California and the UFOs emerging from the water, the USOs. Now, Preston, your research on Catalina Island has been extensive. Any new developments there?
I'm still trying to track down. There's one case that I'm just really intrigued by, which involves 11 witnesses. So it's very unusual to have that large of a group who apparently had missing time as well. And it's just an astounding case. This group of 11 people were all, this was back in the mid-1980s when they had
yes.
this experience. And they were a group of up-and-coming writers and actors and photographers and musicians. In fact, the main witness I interviewed, he had a bit part on the TV series Fame. He's appeared on Three's Company and The Jeffersons, and he currently resides in New York, and he's a writer for a newspaper. But his name is Jonathan Fox, and he is the guy I've interviewed most. I've interviewed a couple of other people who were involved in this incident, and two of these people are actually very... they're celebrities. One's a sitcom actress, very well known, and another is a movie actress, also very, very well known. And unfortunately, they have declined to be interviewed and don't even want to talk about it because it was a pretty traumatic event for some of these people. How it began was they saw these lights hovering over the water, and they're trying to figure out, well, what is this? Is this a plane? You know, but these lights were not moving. They were in a triangular formation, and they were just kind of hanging there. And they were thinking, well, is this a plane? Is it a plane coming in for a landing at Catalina Island? Well, Catalina does have an airport, but it's very, very small. And in fact, it's got one of the most dangerous runways of any airport around. It's very, very dangerous, and there's been some fatal accidents, in fact, that have occurred there. And so planes don't land at night, and it was getting dark when they first started seeing these lights, and after an hour passed, these lights were still there, and it was dark, and they had no idea what these things were. And they were trying to figure it out and, you know, kind of wondering. Finally, someone brought up the term UFO, and everyone pretty much agreed, well, yeah, that's what we think it is. And at this point, this is when it got really strange. Suddenly, smaller objects started coming out of the larger objects, and these smaller objects came zooming towards the group and whirling around them. And this is when people started to get really scared and disoriented. And if there was missing time, this is probably when it occurred. But what I find so fascinating is they had a bunch of cameras that had flashlights, and every single one of them failed. Every camera failed. Every flashlight failed. So really astonishing. Some of the people got very, very upset. They started to have panic attacks. Some of the ladies there started crying. One person was so upset, she started throwing up. The temperature was also, there were some weird temperature variations. It was a relatively warm night. This was in July. But suddenly the temperature dropped dramatically. This weird fog came rolling in. They said it was like a scene straight out of Close Encounters, honestly. And some of the people just got so upset, they decided to leave the campsite. This was actually up in the top of the mountains on Catalina Island, and it's sort of a rural area, Blackjack Campgrounds. And so a couple of people ran down the pathway to try and get to their cars, which, you know, is actually quite a hike. And it was a couple of these people who saw a very large craft, you know, circular, with apparently little lights around it. And so it wasn't just lights that they were seeing. And at some point, you know, there apparently was missing time because it got... It was suddenly a lot later than they had realized. And these lights were zooming around them, and everyone was screaming when they heard this very loud engine noise. They're like, what's that? And these Air Force jets came zooming right overhead as if chasing these objects, which they did, actually. And the objects, as soon as these jets came, the objects descended down and disappeared into the water. And they all had some, you know, a huge psychological reaction to this. One guy actually ended up committing suicide about a year or a few months later. Jonathan Fox, he became completely obsessed with UFOs. another lady. She changed her life path. She was going to be an actress. She ended up becoming a healer, which I find very interesting because that seems to be a very strong theme in people who have very close encounters. And, but it's just a really complicated and extensive case, which is taking a lot of investigations, but it's just fascinating.
It certainly sounds fascinating. Preston, did these people, it sounds as though they had as complicated a reaction spectrum as though in those involved in the Coronado Island incident. Now, and just a brief comment here. I've heard, unfortunately, of a link between UFO sightings and viewing the phenomenon and later untimely deaths. And in fact, that was brought up in one segment. It was a brief segment of a very interesting MUFON meeting up in Greeley about three weeks back. And they were describing a very interesting case in Kansas. But now, these people, I'm sure that they contacted you at length, Preston. For example, did any of them feel that they had implants? I know at the Coronado Island development in that major case back in 1994, Dr. Lear actually removed one of those implants, and those people, too, went through a definite time of adjustment.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. As far as I know, none of the witnesses in the Catalina Island case are aware of any implants, but you know, to a certain extent, they've had difficulty dealing with it. Jonathan Fox, he's probably the only one who's really gung-ho about it and really interested in investigating it. And he actually has a history of UFO sightings stretching back to his childhood, and he's continued to have encounters afterwards. He had recently a sighting maybe a year or two ago, where he resides in upstate New York, which is, of course, its own major hotspot. But as far as implants, I'm not aware of that. But it's not at all unusual for people to have a physical reaction of some kind if they've had a very, very close encounter. And as far as untimely death, that's kind of news to me. I haven't heard that, and I haven't actually run across that, really. I know that there are injury cases associated with people who are too close to a UFO. 400 or 500 on record had health problems as a result of their UFO encounter. And by and large, most of these are involved perhaps the abduction experience or eye irritation or eye problems. That is it's common enough where I ask people, do you have any eye problems? Because people will have dry eyes. And Jonathan Fox is a perfect example. He's like, he cannot stand bright lights. They hurt his eyes. And this is another thing. Light sensitivity is something that's very common among abductees. But, you know, ETs are not here to hurt people. I don't see any evidence of them being sadistic. I don't see any evidence of, you know, them purposefully trying to scare people or hurt people, which we do, you know, humans, you know, Nazi-like behavior, we have a very terrible history of being just awful to each other. And there's none of that among the ETs. Yes, they scare people, and yes, they have hurt people, but it doesn't seem to be purposeful. In fact, you know, the first book I ever wrote was UFO Healings, and that covered 100 cases of people who had their health improved as a result of a UFO encounter. I listed 100 cases in that book, just over 100, and now there's twice that many on record. And I think there's a lot more because people don't really come forward with accounts of, you know, having their health improved by a UFO because of this, you know, the skeptical that UFO healings are a lot more common than, you know, even UFO investigators realize. And these healings cover the full spectrum of illnesses, everything from colds to cancer. And every time I lecture about a UFO healing, someone there in the audience comes up to me afterwards and reveals their own encounter. So I think that shows that there is a good side to these ETs. I don't think they're here to take over our planet. They could certainly have done that a long time ago if they wanted. On the other hand, they're clearly not here to save us either. Otherwise, we wouldn't have millions of people dying of AIDS and, you know, heart disease and all the terrible illnesses that we suffer from. For the most part, they're kind of laissez-faire. They help to a certain extent as much as they can. In fact, one couple I interviewed, they had an experience in Arizona where this UFO was following them.
Kind of, yes.
It was playing a cat and mouse kind of game. And they're like, well, this is odd. And so this was near Sedona, Arizona.
Right, 1995. Mm-hmm.
And as they were driving, they saw this object actually go and land on the ground, and they thought it went into the ground and disappeared. But that's not what happened. They had missing time is what happened. And because they got home, or actually to their hotel, and it was just god-awful late. They're like, what happened to all the time? And it took them a little bit to realize what had happened. And they eventually went under hypnosis. The husband wasn't able to recall anything of any significance other than that the UFO landed and they were invited aboard. They weren't abducted. They went aboard of their own free will. Now, the wife, she recalled extensively a lot of the details. And she said that the ETs that they saw were not gray type. They were much more human looking. They did have large, dark eyes. They did have kind of whitish skin, and they were bald. But otherwise, they could have passed for human. They could have walked down the street, and no one would have given them a second glance, you know, wearing sunglasses and a hat. So, and she said that, you know, she spoke with these ETs, and she asked them, well, where do you come from? And they said, we come from a place you don't know about yet. Typically evasive answer. ETs are they're not talkative. They're not loquacious. And they kind of seem to be very reluctant to give up information. And but they did tell her that they are trying to help people, but they can only help people so much, and that it's up to us to help ourselves, and that it wouldn't solve our problems if they were to just come in here and fix everything, fix the ozone layer, stop pollution, you know, stop nuclear things, because we need to learn our own life. If they were to do that, the consequence would be much worse for us, because we would take advantage of it. We would continue to do the things that we are doing, which is destroying our environment, and so on. So, yeah, I think that there are very positive cases out there. We just don't hear a lot about them.
Well, you know, and you really present a very articulate, very compelling argument. Now, I've got a question here. I was, again, surprised that when they viewed the craft in the Sedona area, that the interior of the craft itself was rather sparse as far as equipment.
Yeah.
May I ask you a question? You know, there have been several UFO models described, and it's almost as though they're archetypal. It's almost as though it's a stylized UFO model. Even now, I'm going to mention Michael Schrath's presentation because I thought it was super at the IU FOC meeting this past February. Even one of the models that he seemed to discuss, I believe it was the Kingman one. I could be mistaken. It had a sparse craft interior. What do you think that's about?
You know, that is such a good question, because I keep running across that, and it bothers me a little bit, because these witnesses that are telling me when they come on board a craft, they don't see instrumentation. And in fact, what they see reminds them a lot of, you know, a cheap Star Trek set. Maybe there might be a few monitors, there might be a few colored lights and knobs, but for the most part, one guy said that there was absolutely nothing in the UFO. And, you know, like a seat will be that all that's there. And my feeling is that some of these craft may be operated by mind power. And I know how that sounds, but mm-hmm. we have not even begun to tap our own mental abilities. And I think these ETs are, a lot of them, are much more in tune with their own minds, things that we would consider paranormal or miraculous, like telepathy. Telepathy is, of course, standard on UFO, onboard UFO accounts. And telekinesis, things like this. these are things that we consider, you know, supernatural, when really they're not. These are just natural abilities which we are only beginning to wake up to. So I think in some cases, this is how these craft are being operated. Could be that they're being remote controlled. It could be that they're just very well designed and the engines don't need all this instrumentation. But I keep running across that over and over again. You know, while we're on the subject, another thing that's baffled me is the size of UFOs. I don't know if I've talked to you about this either, but I always ask people, well, how big was the UFO you were in? And one guy told me, you know, he gave me this answer that I couldn't tell you how big it was because the room kept changing sizes. And
yes.
I'm like, what? And he says, yeah, you know, at one point it would appear to be small, and another time it would be much, much larger. And I talked to another guy who was taken aboard a triangular-shaped craft. He asked the ETs, how big is this UFO? How big is this craft? And they actually laughed. And they said, oh, well, we can make it any size we want. So there are lots of accounts out there of really small UFOs or UFOs that change size. Betty Andreasen, she's a very well-known abductee. She was at one point taken into a craft which shrunk down to like a tiny little ping pong size object and took off. So these ETs have incredible technology, just incredible. And I think that's part of the reason we're baffled when, you know, we hear these descriptions of the inside of UFOs as being very sparse. So it's hard to say, you know, that's kind of like the million-dollar question. If we knew how these things were operated, I think we would have a lot more, you know, for example, the UFOs that are being held by our government in Area 51 and Wright-Patterson, there are some, to my understanding, some UFOs that we have not even been able to get inside or open. And some of them that we do get inside, we can't operate them. We don't see any knobs, we don't see any ignition keys or buttons or steering wheels or anything like this. So it's their technology appears to be not only, you know, a few hundred years ahead of us, or even a few thousand, but perhaps, you know, millions of years ahead of us. So it's a real puzzle, I think, for even our most advanced scientists to figure out.
Very intriguing comments. Now, I remember looking at the UFO healings, True Accounts of People Healed by Extraterrestrials, one of your many fine books, that you reference a case investigated by researcher Dr. David Jacobs. The client, a young girl, reported healing. She had been suffering from a near-terminal case of diphtheria. She was saved with the assistance of aliens, allegedly.
Right.
That's a very interesting case. Also,
yeah,
I'm sorry.
Yeah, her parents didn't want to inoculate her for religious reasons. And apparently, mm-hmm. The ETs, why they heal some people and others is a mystery to me. I really looked for patterns deeply on this. It's evenly split between men and women. It's evenly, you know, certainly there's a lot of people who have never had a UFO experience who have been healed. A lot of them have had UFO experiences. That seems to be evenly split as well. It's really hard to say why some people are being healed and why others aren't. And why a child would be healed of diphtheria, I don't know. Maybe they saw something in her future. Maybe they felt that she would do something important for the planet. I think that's probably, you know, one of the reasons, because that's one of the patterns I noticed, is that people who are being healed are often inventors or doctors or social workers or doing something good for the planet. It's a very loose association, but it was strong enough where I noticed it. So I didn't mean to interrupt, but that thought, I didn't want to lose it. So just think it's really interesting.
No, very intriguing comments. And I also I found very interesting the 1989 case of an Oregon real estate broker who was struck by a lightning bolt. Apparently the ETs treated her to reverse systemic damage.
Right. Lightning strikes can be very dangerous. And in fact, they're not always dangerous. I think I included this in the book. There's a few cases of people who have been healed of lightning strikes, by lightning strikes, rather, of a multiple sclerosis, I believe it was. Mm-hmm. But this lady, Katarina Wilson.
Yes, that is her name.
And she suffered a near lightning strike, and was immediately afterwards visited by ETs who placed this thing over her heart and told her, "Well, your heart was damaged by the lightning, and we're repairing it." And she found it kind of a traumatic experience, but apparently, you know, she believes that they were. That's what they told her that they were doing, and boy, she has had so many ETs who has written an autobiography about her experiences, and she continues to be active in the field. So, very amazing lady, and I have to hand it to her for, you know, bravely coming forth and telling about her encounters. But yeah, she's only one of many people who have had healings.
Very intriguing. Now, Preston, have you heard of negative results from negative ET encounters whereby, for example, not just the trauma that many people report, but also serious flu-like illnesses or infections, even if not intentionally incurred, and sometimes with marks such as geometric formations or patterns, and then soon after the person becomes ill?
I have. And in fact, it seems to be a pretty common reaction to an abduction experience is having flu-like symptoms. And these can be pretty serious. One guy I talked to, I wrote about this in the Coronado Island book.
Yes.
He's a car mechanic and lives with his wife, who does not like UFOs, does not want to hear about them, was kind of upset after that he allowed himself to be interviewed for this book. She you know, allowed it, and he, because he thought it was an important case. And anyway, he, like all the other witnesses in this Coronado Island case, has a history of encounters, and I believe it was before this Coronado Island incident that he had this feeling that something was going to happen, and it just became so pronounced that he's like, oh, all right, whatever's going on, I just wish it would happen now. And this is something, again, I run across. People have a kind of I'll call it a precognition of upcoming encounter. And certainly I've heard that enough where, you know, I believe it to be true. And so he was experiencing that. And sure enough, ETs showed up that night. And he said it was your typical gray-type ET, except it looked very, very old. It had kind of wrinkled skin, had a little bit of sparse white hair on it. And it was just kind of sitting there at the foot, or standing there, rather, at the foot of his bed. And he became extremely frightened, very traumatized. Sweat broke out all over his body. His heart started racing a mile a minute. He thought he was going to have a heart attack. And he blacked out. And when he woke up the next morning, he did not feel well at all. And he, in fact, he felt so sick, he had to rush to the doctors, to the hospital. And the doctors were baffled. He found out that pretty much every orifice in his body, you know, his ears, his mouth, everything, had a really bad infection. And they kept asking, well, how did this happen? How could you get an infection in so many different areas of your body all at once? This is very, very unusual. And he didn't want to tell them. He didn't want the, you know, the men in the white coats to come and take him away. And which is a problem, I think. It would be a much nicer if people felt safe to tell their doctors what truly happened. Because that's another thing I run across again and again, is patients are what happened. So he didn't. Medicine, and his health improved. But yeah, I do run across cases where people have medical problems as a result of their encounters, and it definitely does turn up. But, of course, you get the opposite as well. One lady I spoke with, she lived in Acton, and she was pregnant, and she had gestational diabetes. And she also had, like, at one point, a tumor in her cyst. And in both of these cases, ETs came and helped her. She was about to have this cyst removed. ETs showed up. She doesn't have a lot of recall of what happened, other than that there was a visitation, and she went to the doctor to have her cyst removed, and they're like, well, this is odd, your cyst is gone, is only present after you have had surgery. So, did you go to another doctor after you've had surgery? He says, no, I didn't. And they're like, well, here's a laser scar. You must have had surgery because we can see a scar right here. And there was a scar there. It was healed over already. But she's like, no, I've never, ever had surgery. I have no history of surgery there. So they didn't believe her, and she didn't want to tell them, which again, is unfortunate. But they healed her, apparently, in that case. So, I run across that, definitely. But for the most part, I don't have cases where people are hurt really badly, there's a few cases where people have some unusual illnesses, which they attribute to, their close encounter. But for the most part, people are returned and they have no apparent ill health effects. But again, it's hard to say. There are a lot of cases where people will have suddenly spontaneous remissions of cancer. And some people attribute this to an angelic visitation. They say their room filled with a divine light. This could very well be an EP encounter. So it's kind of hard to interpret some of these cases.
Thank you. That was really a very thoughtful, detailed answer to my question. Appreciated. Now, Preston, you mentioned in your work that argument that some people believe that ET healings could represent simply the ET need to maintain the health of a research subject versus
right.
and perhaps an altruistic motive on the part of the ETs. You would probably weigh in on the latter, that they're doing this in sort of a humanitarian, however one would describe that fashion.
I try to remain objective and kind of let the witness speak for themselves. I personally don't think that that's such a good question, because there are some cases where I really do feel like the ETs are being friendly to these people, and they're helping them out of the goodness of their hearts. On the other hand, there are definitely cases where, in particular cases where women are being used to produce hybrid babies, and there are several cases like that where the ETs will maintain their health, apparently because they've got an agenda. Their race is dying. This is something I hear over and over again, that they've suffered extreme genetic damage as a result of, it's not clear, but of some type of war, whether it's nuclear or chemical or what have you. It's not entirely clear to me. But I must have run across this firsthand at least 4 or 5 times and have read about it dozens of times, where ETs tell the witnesses flat out that, yeah, we've had severe genetic damage. And this is, it's interesting. I think a clue to that being true is the fact that when we have genetic damage, one of the first things to go is our hair and our facial features. People's noses and things like this can become very damaged, the lips and other soft tissues. And this is exactly what's happening with the ETs. They have very diminutive facial features, very white skin, very thin white skin, no hair. So it does appear that they are suffering from genetic damage and are trying to improve taking some of our genes and creating hybrids, which to me kind of raises questions about our relationship with these ETs and human origins, for that matter. Are we related to these guys or not? Because if they can interbreed with us or use our genes, well, we've got to have some similarities there.
Yes, those raise some very interesting concepts there. And, your argument elements do seem credible. And your research is certainly extensive. You would have the cases to back up your statements.
Yeah, you mentioned implants earlier.
Oh, yes, let's go. I'd love to go to that Coronado Island case. Yes.
Another comment I wanted to make about implants is, I think for the most part, even within the UFO field, people think that implants are used for tracking and that that's their main purpose, or for even mind control. But I've been told by several witnesses that the purpose for these implants is multiple. There's multiple purposes. Mm-hmm. And one lady, she told me that she asked the ETs, and they said, oh, well, we are using these implants to measure the levels of pollution in your body, because you guys are polluting your bodies, and we don't understand why you're doing it, and that's what we're trying to research. And so I think that's one very positive reason for implants. And another person was told that it's actually to boost the immunity levels in our bodies. So another very positive reason for implants. And, you know, I think if someone does have an abduction experience, more likely than not, they do have an implant. Hard to say, you know, I don't want to speculate here, but I believe it's so often these scars and that appear in the same place, and they're also generational. Like one lady I talked to, she has this scar on her leg, and which she's had since her childhood. Well, her little daughter came running into her room one day and says, "Mommy, Mommy, this man visited me." And she's like, "Really?" And she didn't, her parents, the mother's parents did not believe her, but she decided to, you know, believe her daughter because of her own experiences and her own recall. And she examined her daughter and found a scar in exactly the same place, an identical scar on her leg. And so, which makes you wonder, you know, is she being implanted as well? And certainly ETs seem to express an interest in families. And as far as generations, there are cases where ET contact is going back 3, 4, 5 generations even. So they've been here for a while. I know the modern age of UFOs is said to begin in 1947 or so. And I think that's really when we sort of became aware. You know, it's interesting, before the 1900s, the idea of aliens was not in the popular culture at all. Anytime there was an astronomical event, people did not think aliens. They thought angels. They thought, you know, spirits. They thought miracles, something like that. The idea of aliens did not come around until the 1900s or so. So I think we're finally beginning to wake up. And hopefully this is the true answer of what's happening, because I'm a big believer in aliens. I know there are lots of theories to explain UFOs, everything from time travelers to cultural control systems and interdimensional beings, but I really think we hit up on the answer now with extraterrestrials. I'm a huge believer that that's exactly what we're dealing with.
You know, that's an intriguing, well, actually, all of your comments here have been very intriguing. They always are. You're an excellent researcher. But when you mentioned that, your last statement, it reminds me, we have a very bright ICAR person here, and boy, our ICAR group here are extremely bright, so are our visitors to the chat room here on UPRN. But his question, he has two questions. One of them is, what are your thoughts on the extraterrestrial hypothesis? And you seem to have very eloquently just stated them now.
Yeah, well, you know, I think ETs is the best explanation. You know, it fits most of the evidence. Certainly there are some anomalies or some major questions that I have about the ET hypothesis. One being, like, say the airship wave of the 1890s, which involves Zeppelin-like craft with human-looking aliens or human-looking beings, I should say, and which were often speculated to be from a foreign country, not another planet. And Zeppelins were invented in, like, 1904. So could these have been humans who had invented Zeppelins and were not forthcoming about it? It's entirely possible. But the first major UFO wave was that great airship wave of the 1890s. And,
yes.
And that was different from what we're seeing now. And it sort of fell off pretty quickly. It lasted, you know, 5-10 years, and we had almost no activity through the, you know, 1900s, 1910, 1920, even 1930. It wasn't until, like, the 1940s when, you know, Sweden and Europe started getting these ghost rockets or missile-type craft. And now we have, you know, in the 1950s, it was the flying saucer. And now we're seeing a lot more of these triangular-shaped craft. And another thing that really baffles me about the whole ET hypothesis is, how come we never see the same aliens more than once? I know the gray type, I'd say of all the people I've interviewed, 70% or even more, 80% C see some variation of the gray type ET. But I have yet to run across a case where someone saw an ET and they described it in detail with their uniform and, you know, the little symbols on it. And then another person says, I saw that same exact ET, you know, so, or the same exact ship. We have so many different types of ships, so many different types of ETs that how many can there be? It's just baffling to me. And what's their society like? I mean, how are they organized? Do they have a government? These are a lot of the questions I have. But on the other hand, you know, the ET hypothesis, it makes sense because we have these metallic objects. They are being recorded on radar. Certainly, we're chasing them. We've had metal fragment cases, many of them. And in many of these cases, the metals do appear to have some unusual properties. We have landing trace cases, thousands of landing trace cases. We have people who have gotten too close to these craft and suffered what appears to be a radiation-type illness. And, you know, to cap it off, when these things land, we see these figures coming out, and they look like ETs. And, you know, people said, oh, it's science fiction. You know, this is what people has sparked the whole UFO movement. I think the reverse is true, that the UFOs have sparked the science fiction movement. So, I don't know. It's hard to say. I still think that ETs is the single kind of intriguing one is time travelers. And because there are many cases where ETs apparently do time travel. One case that comes to mind was this lady I interviewed, and she was in a car accident. And she said her injuries were terrible. She was actually thrown up. Her car collided with another, and she was thrown through the windshield. And the windshield broke, and she was found, you know, a distance from her own vehicle. And the doctors were amazed because there was no injuries on her face at all. And she recalled actually being taken on board a craft and healed. And the ETs told her, well, you actually perished. You died in this accident, and we were able to revive you and repair your body because karmically you were not supposed to die. Karmically you were supposed to have a certain amount of injuries, and we're not going to repair those, but we are going to save your life. And that's what they did. And they placed her back at the scene of the accident after it occurred. So she spent like an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours aboard this UFO, and then boom, she was back at the scene of the accident right after it occurred. So they apparently do have the ability to travel in time. And there's a number of other cases where abductees have been told flat out, you are us. You are related to us. This is why we're contacting you, because you are one of us. And which, you know, raises the question, you know, who are we and who are these ETs? Are they time travelers? And I know Jim Sparks, he's a well-known abductee or a contactee, perhaps, would be a bit. And he says also that he's experienced many incidents of time travel, so or time traveling ETs, rather. So that is the hypothesis. Are the ETs us in the future? Do we have like a major nuclear war here and genetic damage, and then in the future we're coming back and trying to prevent it? You know, that's a possibility. As far as interdimensional beings, oh, what is that? You know, that there's really not a lot you can hang your hat on there. It's really hard to say. And I always tell people, well, we ourselves are interdimensional too. We have souls. You know, I believe that there is existence after death. I am certain we can go out of our bodies. I've had many astral experiences myself following the death of my mother. I picked up a book on how to do out-of-body experiences, and at one point, boy, I got really good at it, enough to convince myself that it's absolutely true. And I've taught classes on how to do it. I've taught people in my family how to do it, you know, friends. So we're interdimensional beings, too.
Boy, those are powerful points there, and I can't wait, Preston, until the second half of this interview to mention your pioneering work there, out of body exploration, lucid dreaming, astral travel with the out of body exploration.
Yeah, it's all connected. It definitely is connected to the whole UFO experience. You know, it's funny, and I started having these experiences, you know, shortly after I got involved in investigating UFOs. And whenever I interview someone, I'm like, well, you know, who's had a UFO experience, I always ask them, well, have you ever had any other unusual experiences? And a lot of them have had near-death experiences or precognition or out-of-body experiences. And in fact, one guy, he was a pilot, a commercial pilot. He had a very close-up encounter with a UFO, and he reported it, and he was visited a few weeks later, by some people from the government. They said they were from some aspect of the government. And they gave him a list of questions. You know, how fast did this UFO move? You know, did you have any physical effects from it? Did you hear anything? All the normal questions that you would ask a witness. And then they asked him, well, have you had any out-of-body experiences following this sighting? And the pilot's like, well, yes, I did. You know, in the weeks following it, I had a number of out-of-body experiences. So I think that there is a trigger there, or ETs are somehow waking up this ability in people. And certainly they are very interested in people who are psychic, and that comes across over and over and over again. People are either have their psychic abilities increased as a result of a very close encounter, or that they already have a lot of psychic experiences, and lo and behold, here comes a UFO. And another very common thing is following a close-up sighting, even, or a UFO abduction, people will have poltergeist activity in their home. So, yeah, it's all connected. Somehow it's all connected.
I've heard that as well. And, you know, Preston, I appreciate strongly your finding that the various encounters, although often reflecting some aspect of a pattern, are also individual and unique in nature. That's very well said.
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, there's a book out there by Kenneth Ring, The Omega Point, or The Omega something. I forget the exact title. But Kenneth Ring is a near-death researcher, and he noticed this connection, too, and he wrote a book commenting on all the commonalities between near-death experiences and UFO abductions, and tried to kind of make a hypothesis that perhaps they were the same phenomena. I don't think so. I think that they're related. There's a lot of similarities, but I don't think that they're the same. And I think this is where a lot of UFO researchers kind of miss the boat, is they're not interested in ghosts. They don't want to hear about your precognition or your ability to do healing or channeling. But you know what? That's a piece of the puzzle, and it is connected, obviously, because it's so consistent. And I think that it's a mistake to ignore evidence. And I understand, you know, particularly like groups like MUFON want to focus on the nuts and bolts aspect of UFOs. But they're not nuts and bolts solely. I mean, certainly I do believe these are solid metallic craft, and the evidence is overwhelming in that regard. But on the other hand, there's a whole psychic aspect to it, and it would be a huge mistake, I think, to ignore it. And I remember when I was early on in my research, this was during when I was researching the Topanga Canyon UFO wave. I wrote a book about that whole wave of sightings, which took place in 1992 to 1994. That place is still very, very active. But there was one case I was researching where a group of teenagers were at one of the friends' homes, and they saw this little craft fly over the house. Like, wow, what was that? Did you see that? It was just this little object with lights on it, and it was followed by two more identical-looking craft. And then out of, you know, over the horizon comes this very large craft. It wasn't saucer-shaped. It was very oddly shaped, kind of block-shaped. It had tiny little lights all around it and came really low down over the house there and shined a beam of light right on the house. And one of the witnesses told me, he's like, Preston, honestly, I wish I could tell you what it was, what I saw, but I was just too darn scared to even look at it. He wanted to hide under the house. Another of the witnesses, Gabe is his name, he had had prior UFO experiences and was not afraid at all. In fact, he told me it took all his effort not to jump up and run into that beam of light, because he was just fascinated by it. He gave a really wonderful description of this craft. And he says, you know, as it moved away, it turned transparent. It wasn't even out of view, and suddenly it just became kind of vaporish and translucent. You could see the stars through it, and it sort of disappeared as it moved away. And when I heard that, I'm like, that doesn't sound right. I wonder if he's misperceiving. But he was the best witness of the group of these four kids. And so I'm like, gosh, no, I can't throw that away. I've heard that before. But I'm just going to back burner, and, I don't know what to make of it. Lo and behold, cases came down the pipeline, and sure enough, more and more people started telling me the same thing. They said, this craft was transparent. Or, the craft moved through the trees, through the forest. Not knocking down trees, but actually moving through them. So some of these, these were clearly dealing with something that is just so strange, it's really hard for us to get a handle on it. But there are paranormal aspects to it.
Very intriguing comments. Now, Preston, quick question. Have you received reports that sometimes the ETs themselves can look transparent for a moment or two?
Yes. And that's not at all uncommon. And they can turn invisible, in fact. And I think this is what some of the poltergeist activity actually is.
Mm-hmm.
And people will be reporting, footsteps and knocking noises. There are many, many cases where ETs do turn transparent. Not just ETs, the UFOs themselves, well, I already mentioned that. But yeah, people will have ETs suddenly just appear right in front of them, boom. And I think they have invisibility technology, which, Harry Potter and the invisibility cloak, it sounds like fantasy, but turns out we're making major strides ourselves with invisibility. And you know how the blue screen works in movies? They can put a screen behind an actor and put them in an environment that they're not even in.
Neutral format.
Mm-hmm. Right, and so it looks like they're on a different world, like, that movie Avatar. Well, using that technology, they're able to take a blue screen and put it in front of a person and basically have it project the environment that's behind them. So in essence, they become transparent by wearing this invisibility suit, which sounds like fantasy, like science fiction, but no, and this is what we have to really wonder, what we're not being told, because as I'm sure if you look into this field of technology and inventions and the progress of technology, a lot of the stuff we're seeing is decades old. These flat screen TVs that are so popular now, I talked to a guy years ago who told me that way back in the 50s, we had already perfected that technology, and it's only just now being released to us. And I don't know if you heard about this, but there's this billboard that they put up in New York, and this was on the news, mainstream news, and I haven't heard anything about it since. But if you walk up in front of this billboard, it actually projects a voice into your head, not audibly, but through some sort of electromagnetic beam, and which activates our auditory senses and has a message, buy this taco sauce or what have you. So as far as hearing voices, well, we now have that ability to put that into someone's head without using actual sound waves. So we're getting a handle on some of this ET technology ourselves, which is only very, very slowly being released. And boy, I just finished writing this book about Nevada, UFOs over Nevada, to follow up another book I wrote, UFOs over New Mexico and UFOs over California and UFOs over New York. I want to do every state. It's going to take me 50 years probably. But boy, the stuff that's coming out of Area 51, I thought I knew about that. But boy, oh boy, the technology there is straight out of science fiction.
We have about 4 minutes left now, or 3 minutes left to our mid-break here, mid-interview break, but I'd love to discuss that with you. Also, I noticed a question here in the chat room from Rydell. It's very intriguing. Does Preston have any knowledge of UFO ET activity sightings at the Rocket Dive facility in Simi Valley, California?
You know, I do hear about that, and I live very near that area. And I've talked to a number of people who have had sightings over that area. And there's a few people I know who are having contact as well. And so, yes, I think what we're having is a case of there was some very bad nuclear spills in this area, some nuclear contamination. And wherever there's nukes or nuclear power, UFOs will show up. Boy, I'm sure we're going to hear something about this whole Japan crisis sooner or later.
May I make a comment on that, Preston? This is a theory. I have a close friend, an excellent researcher here, right in Colorado, who believes that the sighting Monday night, March 21st, in Lafayette, Colorado, might have been prompted by aliens measuring and monitoring the radioactivity in the air. It was not considered harmful over here, thank God, in America, and God protect the Japanese. What do you think on that?
I think you're right on the money there. Like I said, it's all about nukes when it comes to UFOs. This is what started the whole, you know, that giant super wave of 1947, probably the biggest UFO wave the Earth has ever experienced, just swept across the planet. It was enormous. UFOs were seen in extremely large numbers on that summer, which coincides so closely with the atomic age, and certainly most UFO researchers, I'm going to say, I would like to say all, but, you know, there's always going to be someone out there who disagrees. But pretty much, by and large, the UFO researchers agree that there's a connection there between the dawning of the atomic age and the arrival of all these UFOs. And there are case after case after case after case of UFOs hovering over nuclear power plants. Case after case after case of UFOs where people got too close to a UFO and they suffered some type of radiation sickness. So my guess is a lot of these UFOs, or some at least, do use nuclear power and are very intrigued by our use of it and worried about it. And I think, yes, they are measuring the level of radiation on our planet, and that is one of their major concerns. And in fact, if someone's taken aboard a UFO, the first thing they experience is, of course, an examination. But often they're given warnings about nuclear proliferation. Very, very, very common.
Wonder. Boy, that really... rouses my curiosity. Yes, those are very interesting and intriguing comments. Now, Preston, in about 15 seconds here, we go to break. In the second hour, I'd love to discuss with you your research on ghost hunting, levitation, lucid dreaming, and out-of-body exploration. Also, any additional ufology points you'd like to introduce. Great interview. I can't wait until the second hour begins. That will be about 10 minutes after the hour. See you all back after the break.
The Church of Mavis with hosts Jeffrey Richard and Godwin. 10 p.m. Central Saturdays. Opening the gates of the underworld and calling down beings of ancient starlight. Tune in, watch for the apocalypse on the paranormal radio network. Come to our forum at mavisincarnate.com.
will you do the fandango? Thunderbolt and lightning, very, very frightening me.
Galileo, Galileo,
Galileo,
Magnifico.
I'm just a poor boy, nobody loves me.
He's just a poor boy from a poor family, sparing his life from this one company.
Mamma mia,
mamma mia, let me go. Beelzebub has the devil put aside for me, for me, for me.
Light up your night with the Kevin Smith Show. Hi, this is Kevin Smith. Join me Monday through Friday right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Are you interested in a radio program that focuses on the deeper aspects of the UFO topic? Would you like to explore the facts and truths of what ufology and UFO research are all about? And please join us here every Saturday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Central for Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, with your host, D. Andrew, right here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. And remember, UFO research is not a belief system.
Hi, you've got to listen to ICAR, that's International Community for Alien Research, www.icar1.com. I should know, I'm Irish.
Tree Sheridan, host of A Global Focus. Broadcast resume Friday nights from 10 to 12 Eastern on the Paranormal Radio Network. Come join the discussion.
Tune in to UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
everyone to A Global Focus. Tonight's program features author Preston Dennett, MUFON field investigator, ufologist, ghost hunter, and paranormal researcher and pioneer. Author, researcher, ufologist, paranormal field pioneer. Preston Dennett's website can be found at home.pacbell.net /Prestone. Prestone. Again, home.pacbell.net, /Prestone, Prestone. Now, Preston's books are excellent, and I would like to mention here the wonderful illustrations therein provided by researcher and artist Christine Cassara Dennett, Preston's sister. And at this, we have a few questions remaining, very good ones as always, from our room for the top part of this hour. But next we're going into, as well, Preston's excellent research in the fields of lucid dreaming, out-of-body exploration, ghost hunting, levitation. Preston, I hope I can say this, Preston was mentioning how these particular fields directly impact on individuals. They are of prime importance, and I'm adding here that Preston believes that they have great impact and importance. Now, Preston, two questions here I want to bring up. First, from an individual in our chat, in our discussion, Yana F., and I had it right here, and it was interesting because he mentions the triangle, and of course the triangle is from what I've heard and from other sources and from experience, the triangle can have importance. I wonder if the guest, this is from Yana F., I wonder if the guest has heard of any ETs that wear a symbol of a circle with a triangle in the center of it. Now, this particular individual has had a UFO experience in 95, but it was a positive experience.
A symbol with a circle with a triangle in the center of it? That is actually,
yes.
Yeah. That is a common symbol, I think, which has turned up in some, I'm trying to think of a specific case where has that symbol on, you know, say like a ET's uniform or on the wall of a ship. I'm sure there's some out there. I can't point to a specific one, but I'll certainly look into it and get back to you if I can find one. But yeah, I believe that that is a symbol that does turn up.
Thank you, Preston. Mm-hmm.
There's an enormous number of symbols. It's one of the tools that researchers can use to corroborate things. It's interesting. I did work on a case with a lady who was having a problem with her skin, where markings would appear on her skin, strange symbols. It was very odd. That, you know, it's kind of like, to say bizarre is, you know, the least. But these strange symbols kept appearing on her skin, and she never could identify them until suddenly she was watching that TV movie, Intruders, which showed actual symbols as reported by, you know, people who've had onboard experiences. So she was shocked. There were the symbols that were on her body or appearing on TV. So that's another place you can look for some true ET symbols is the work of, you know, Bud Hopkins. He's done a lot of research in that.
Very intriguing. Now, the second question, Preston, thank you. The second question is from one of our fine ICAR researchers, and she is wondering what you would suggest as possible paths for research to take in exploring this field, ufology, ET matters.
Right. Well, ufology is crying for serious researchers. It just absolutely needs them desperately, and there's a lot of people who are certainly interested. I would recommend, I think there's two areas that really need research, and that's research into the government cover-up, which is still active. Each time there's a major sighting, you know, like Stevensville is the latest really big case that showed evidence of a government cover-up. That whole area is very changeable right now, very mercurial. I think it's going to explode, and it already is crumbling. So I think there's a lot of room there for research. And by, you know, tracking down government people who are willing to speak and getting their stories told. You know, work like Stephen Greer and Stephen Bassett and others are doing. Another area that's absolutely crying for research is live field work. You know, we have a lot of people writing books about books that have been written about books, but going out there and, you know, calling out UFOs, being there. I've been able to, you know, really well in some cases, is actually there with a UFO witness. Or, so I think, you know, each, we should have cameras that are watching the night sky at all times, you know, and tracking this UFO activity as it occurs. So live field work and ending the government cover-up, where I'd like to see a lot of money and attention thrown.
Colorado, those are wonderful suggestions, yes.
And wasn't it yours, Colorado, that recently tried to pass a UFO bill in the Senate? Or
That wasn't successful, but yet from what I've heard, it was a significant percentage there of votes.
Yeah, 40% voted yes, which is a really close number to spending some money on doing exactly that, live field work and monitoring UFO. And, of course, interviewing witnesses is important as well, and, you know, tracking sighting cases. But those areas were actually, you know, monitoring UFO activity as it occurs and trying to end this cover-up, because we have this technology. If I could tell any last message about UFOs, is that we already have this technology. We have the UFOs in our possession. This is what the evidence is showing us. And we could end the three terrible E's, you know, the letter E in one fell swoop, which is the economic crisis, the energy crisis, and the environmental crisis. Because we have free energy now. It's here. And we don't need to burn all this oil. And the amount of money that we spend on defense and the black budgets is incredible, as I'm sure you must know. Like Michael Schrat talked a lot about that as well.
So. Indeed, he does. That was a very powerful presentation of his. And I've also enjoyed his past presentations, including at the Crash Retrieval Conference. Now, Preston, Out of Body Exploring. Yeah. You've authored Out of Body Exploring, A Beginner's Approach, that due to your out of body exploration, you no longer fear death.
I would say I've greatly reduced my fear. I still, of course, have the whole dying process. This sounds kind of uncomfortable to me. But I certainly know that there is life after death. I mean, all it takes is one really good out-of-body experience where you turn around and you feel yourself pop out of your body, and you turn around and you see your body lying there, and you're taken, you know, you can walk through walls, you can fly, you can go to other dimensions, honest to God, and, you know, to other, I don't know what else to call it, the other side, I guess would be a good word, or some people would call it the heavenly realms. The Eastern religions have it all broken down into like seven different planes of existence. And I picked up this book on out-of-body exploring, that's what got my whole interest started with it.
Now, Preston, I want to get right back to this. Can I please beg your indulgence here? We have that excellent researcher here, and, you know, I'm hoping I correctly asked her question. I didn't realize that there was an abduction focus to it, a precise abduction focus. On the research, when it comes to abductions, what kind of research approach would you like to see? And, again, this is from one of our finest researchers, brilliant mind, Dimensional Stars, her Nick in the room.
Abduction. Someone who's having an abduction experience, is certainly this is a great opportunity for, you know, that live field work. I would like, you know, people to monitor as best as well with security cameras, which, you know, we can do it cheaply now, is, you know, with digital cameras. It's just install a security camera, because this can help provide evidence. And you know, a lot of it depends on the person's, you know, level of where they're at with their abduction experiences. I think the number one thing when you're dealing with an abduction case is the welfare of the witness. And I remember I was contacted a couple of years ago, at least, by this couple who was having extraordinary experiences where UFO apparently abducted the lady and took her baby out of her womb at 7 months pregnancy. So it was a major case, and it's sought out several researchers who seemed only to be interested in their story. And they contacted me, and my primary concern was for their welfare. So I worked with them for a long time. So that's the number one thing I think the approach you want to take when you're dealing with these types of cases is the witness welfare and try to protect them, and the evidence, and trying to get this some conclusive proof of abductions would be second. But I'm convinced abductions are already taking place. I think at the point we do need to start throwing some more money towards education of people, which is why I love your show, Treats, because it's one of the few places people can go to get information on these subjects, which are so important to people. I mean, just think, we could end the energy crisis, the economic crisis, and the environmental crisis overnight. And it's going to happen. This technology has to be released at some point.
I agree, Preston. And, I very much approve of your suggestion that the research should have both an objective and empathic focus. Heavens, I just forgot my next question. And it was relating back to ufology. Well, I'll think of it. Back to out-of-body exploring. What do you consider the benefits of out-of-body exploring?
Oh, they're amazing. I mean, I've collected about 20 or 30 cases of people who had really profound healings of, all kinds of illnesses as a result of an out-of-body experience. And so that's a really good factor. You can visit your past lives and learn a whole lot about yourself. It's absolutely incredible. What I find really just amazing is you can increase your psychic awareness. I hate these words because they don't sound... And I mean, I know how it sounds to some people. I was so skeptical growing up of all this stuff. I didn't have psychic experiences. But doing out-of-body work will absolutely wake up your psychic senses to a profound degree. So, precognition, telepathy, these sort of things. So that's another really good benefit. There's so many. You get to, one of the best benefits is just flying, just the ability to fly. It's an amazing feeling. And another really good benefit is you have a whole secret life. Most people, they go to bed, they wake up, they remember a few dreams. Sometimes they're really profound, But if you develop that ability to have your recall at night and start trying to become conscious, you will wake up to an entire new world where you can explore for, another few hours or all night long if you're really good at it. So it's amazing to essentially increase your lifespan by a third because you're awake. These are not dreams. You are absolutely awake. But you still wake up even more refreshed than normal.
That does sound remarkable. It sounds like a non sequitur, too, but, boy, that sounds intriguing. Now, I was getting the impression that you find from out-of-body exploring that a greater awareness of the universe and dimensions is achieved.
Right. And for me, what happened was, I picked up this book and said, all you have to do is basically do these types of steps. I read every book after that. So I broke it down to about three main steps where it's a physical relaxation, a mental relaxation, and then at that point you do affirmations and visualizations where you try and get out of your body. And so this is what I did. And it worked really well. It took me about 2 weeks of doing, 15 minutes of exercise every night as I fell asleep. And I started having these really lucid type dreams, and suddenly I popped out of my body, and it was very scary. He had talked about a fear barrier. Well, I thought I had died, honestly. And so I popped back into my body, and I woke up, and I was amazed. I was delighted, and I did it again, and I got to the point where I could pop out for a few minutes at a time, and I would walk around, walk through walls. I was able to go to my friends' houses, my family, do stuff to prove that this was not a dream. And at some point, though, you start slipping into other dimensions. It's the oddest thing. If you fly too fast or you pop out on the other side. This is at least my experience. I think this is echoed by other researchers as well, other people who had these experiences. The astral body's natural tendency is to move to the other side because that's kind of where it comes from. And I think it's important for people to realize that the astral body is the better body than the physical one. It's much stronger, it can move much faster, it can fly, it can do all sorts of extraordinary things. And we're essentially projecting down here into a physical body. So when someone's saying, oh, I'm having an out-of-body experience, well, the truth is the physical body is actually the out-of-body experience. Our true selves are on the other side. And boy, when you pop out of body, you can see colors. Everything becomes super real. You suddenly realize that the physical world is a pale reflection of the other side. There's no comparison. There's no comparison. It's a black and white photo. It's like, you know, that whole Wizard of Oz trick where it went from black and white to color. That's how dramatic it is.
Boy, that does sound like a very intriguing environment. But now, Preston, how can one safeguard oneself against intrusion by negative entities while astral traveling?
Right. Well, you know, I researched that to death, and I could not find a lot of evidence of dangers. The thing is, we have what's called a silver cord, and this connects us to our body. And when someone starts to do this kind of out-of-body work, by and large, they're going to have a spirit guide working with them. And again, I know how that sounds, but we all have spirit guides. We all have people who have died who love us and or who have not been born or are working from the other side. And I call it the other side. It's kind of just another dimension. I think that's much closer to us than people realize. And so when you're doing out-of-body experiences, they are there with you, helping you along. And I've searched and searched for any real stories of people who've been injured by this or, you know, hurt in some way or possessed. And honestly, I have not been able to locate it. And a lot of this fear, I think, comes from the early research on this subject. Some of the early books talked about, you know, fears of possession. There's no fear of getting lost. You can go far out as you can imagine, and you can instantly come back to your body. There's no dangers of possession that I can find. If it makes them feel comfortable, people can do white light exercises because it helps put you in a positive frame of mind. And, you know, there are negative entities out there, but it's a very simple matter of just returning to your body if you're uncomfortable at any point. You know, I've had a lot of experiences where I'm like, wow, this is kind of scary, you know, a little bit, or weird. I remember one time I was flying along, and I felt something grab my foot, and it was not a normal human hand. It was like a little webby creature or something. And I just reached down, and I peeled it off, and I kept going. Another time I came to a big barrier I couldn't get through, you know. So there are things that can scare you, but you always end up back in your body, and I couldn't find any cases of injuries or any, you know, coming back too fast or too hard or anything like that.
Very, very interesting. Now, Preston, regarding your own experiences and also your research in the field of out-of-body exploration as well, have you received reports or experienced during your out-of-body exploration, your astral traveling, the presence of aliens, particularly grays, intruding or being present during out-of-body exploration? You referenced here intrusion, no, but how about their presence?
Me personally, no, I haven't. You know, in a lot of my experiences, I've experienced just being alone. You know, I have been able to visit, you know, humans and, you know, deceased pets and, you know, deceased loved ones. And I've been able to visit people who are living. But I have never had experience with grays. I did call out once, I want to see an alien. And an alien appeared in front of me. And it was not a gray. It was some other type of ET. And I can't tell you if it was real or not. But it certainly looked real. I was awake. And this could have been an image that was projected from my consciousness, or it could have been an actual ET, I don't know, but it had a snout and a kind of claws or paws, rather. But it was definitely not a dog. It didn't look like a dog, or I can't even possibly describe it. Kind of an anteater and a dog cross, but it was standing on 2 feet. So I have had a little bit. I've heard of other people who have had encounters with gray-type ETs, and certainly there are people who are having abduction experiences, and they'll have an out-of-body experience while on the ship. So, but there does seem to be some interest in the ETs about people who can do out-of-body experiences. So I wouldn't be surprised if some people have had that, but I haven't.
Thank you very much. Indeed, you make the field, this particular research field, out-of-body exploration, sound very intriguing, multi-aspectual, definitely something worthy of regard.
Oh, I want people to do it so bad, because I can't tell you how much it changed my life. It's just, I mean, like I said, it removes your fear of death. It just makes the psychic aspect is incredible. And learning about yourself and the energy that comes to you and the healing and just the level of awareness that you can get, it's amazing. The intuition you can get about people. But for me, you know, what was so, so much fun is, you know, having precognition, precognitive dreams and premonitions and things like that. So that's a lot of fun.
That sounds very intriguing as well. Can we turn to lucid dreaming at this point as well? Preston, is the purpose of lucid dreaming the concept that by becoming a creator, a co-creator, or an aware actor in your dreams, you're empowering yourself both in the dreamscape and active world environment?
Exactly. It's all about what happens to you when you're awake. It's so amazing because, you know, I thought it was dream work. And I did all this work on lucid dreaming, and the Tibetan Buddhists, they have this whole method of becoming enlightened and through lucid dreaming, where first you become awake in your dreams, and then you learn how to control the dream state. And they've got all these little progressive steps you can take by, like, trying to multiply objects or trying to make things move and, you know, change the environment and control it. And they say once you master that, that ability is sparked into your waking life. And all these abilities kind of, you know, it's our, in the other side, in the lucid dream state, in our dream body, it's the natural ability to levitate. If you get really good at it, you can actually physically levitate. And this is what seems to be the connection to physical levitation as well. So it's, lucid dreaming is absolutely about that. It's about coming first awake in the dream state, and you learn how to control it, and then suddenly you have, you know, precognitive dreams as well. So you realize what the real purpose of dreams is, not just, you know, to psychologically diagnose the type of person you are, but it's actually to use them as an awareness tool to for unusual events that happen throughout your day in life. And it's amazing because what would happen to me is I would have this dream, and the next day, it would play out before me in full color. And I'd be like, wow, so this is, you wake up in your dream life, and your real life, your waking life, becomes more dreamlike. So, because you had dreamt it before it occurred. So it comes full circle. And you really realize that it's all about awareness, and you're not really a whole person. We're walking around in amnesia, honest to God. Because we should all be remembering our past lives. We should all be awake throughout the night. I wish I could do it as good as I used to be able to, but I've kind of fallen out of practice a little bit. It takes a little bit of effort, I think, and discipline and attention and desire and imagination. You mix it all up and you kind of got to really focus on it, I think, to be successful. And certainly that's what I did. And boy, I would really recommend it. And it's, again, just a simple three-step process.
Well, you're an author of a wonderful lucid dreaming work as well, correct, Preston? And this research does sound intriguing. I'm wondering, I was looking actually for the title of the levitation work. All your books are excellent. They're definitely a very worthwhile read. Now, Preston, some believe that certain dreamscapes actually represent recollections of abductions or real-time abductions.
Right.
Do you think lucid dreaming could represent a proactive approach to an event or memory? Could there be a danger in lucid dreaming intervention? What do you think?
I think it's a wonderful tool, and I don't think there's been a lot of research into this with people who have, you know, I recommend lucid dreaming for working out your problems, because actually the astral body is also called the desire body, and what happens is you pop out of your body, and all your issues kind of pop out in full color. You're confronted with, you know, all the problems, the things you haven't worked out, is I guess the best way of putting it. And I think it would be wonderful if someone who's having abduction experiences were able to get lucid in their dream state and essentially ask for some information about, you know, what's happened to them. Because that's what you can do. Lucid dreaming is very closely related to out-of-body exploring and is, in fact, pretty much the same thing. Except in the lucid dream state, you're projecting a kind of a hallucinatory environment around you. Otherwise, you're completely awake. You're absolutely 100% awake. More awake, in fact, than sometimes you are in the waking life. Definitely it's much more close to being awake than sleeping. So sleeping is kind of a misterm when someone's doing lucid dreaming. And there are all sorts of things you can do, and I think recall would be definitely one of them.
Thank you, Preston. Another quick question, too. Have you heard of negative accounts in negative experiences during a lucid dream?
Well, certainly. Nightmares. I haven't had a whole lot of nightmares, but I've had a couple. And you can have very unpleasant things. I remember I was having a lucid dream experience where they're very closely related to out-of-body experiences. So this could be an out-of-body experience as well, but there were elements that were like lucid dreams. But at any rate, I was flying around some other dimension, I'll call it, and I was landed in the field. And on the other side of the field, there was a ball, and I knew it was going to charge me, and sure enough, it did, and it pinned me to the ground, and it was very scary. But I knew it was a dream ball. I knew it represented something that I was trying to work through, and I just kind of petted it and say, "Nice ball, nice ball, nice ball," and it eventually evaporated. But there's another case that was even more scary, really, where I was doing the same thing, flying around, and I landed in the field, and I saw a lion in the tall grass right near me, and it was about to pounce. And I actually did not have a second to react before it was around, its jaws were around my neck and snapping shut. And that was so startling that I honestly just decided to wake up, which is what I did. I just left as fast as I could because it was scary. So, yeah, you can have negative stuff, but I don't think this is why I like lucid dreaming, is because you don't actually get hurt. And this is something you should remember if you ever do out-of-body experiences. You're not physical. You can't be hurt, but So you don't have to worry. It took me like years of courage of having out-of-body experiences before I would fly through telephone wires because I was just scared. But finally I did it, and there was no problem. So I think a lot of doing this work is confronting your fears. As I said, again, this is called the desire body. I had to work through like problems with gluttony. I would pop out of my body or into the lucid dream state, and I would start creating feasts of food and, you know, bags of potato chips and strawberry ice cream, and I would just gorge on it. And it was a very strange experience to eat all this food, which can kind of disappear right when it hits your throat. But it certainly tasted real, I'll tell you that. And so I would have to work through that. I'd have to work through, you know, some lust as well, if I'm going to be perfectly honest. And but once you work through that, you know, some out-of-body explorers put it off, and that's how they get through it. Me, I just did it, and I worked through it, and I remained awake long enough to start having some really awesome, you know, spiritual stuff, learning about my past lives, or, you know, trying to meet a spirit guide, or, you know, meeting a deceased loved one, or things like that.
Now, Preston, you mentioned that levitation is related to these other disciplines. Now, reading descriptions, you've been able to describe the mechanics of levitation. You know that it's been tested under scientific and laboratory conditions, correct?
Yes, it's amazing. I had no idea before I wrote the book. I mean, I started out because I had a friend who reportedly levitated as a child, and I interviewed her, and I was amazed. She flew down a hallway, apparently just flew as a child and was never able to duplicate the experience. And no one saw her do it, but she flew down a hallway and turned a corner and flew down the end of the other hallway and landed. And I found another friend who used to fly up and down stairs, actually a friend of a friend. I didn't know her until I met her. my friend did know her. So I found two people within my, you know, family circle of friends and coworkers and, you know, who could levitate. So that's how I got involved. And I found out that levitation is present in all cultures, as it goes back thousands of years and has, yes, been tested scientifically in scientific labs on several occasions. The famous Brazilian medium Carlos Mirabelli, probably Brazil's most famous medium, was able to levitate more than once in front of groups of scientists who could not explain how he was doing it. As well, Daniel Douglas Home also levitated in front of numerous heads of state, writers, you know, leaders in business, and scientists, including Nobel Prize-winning scientists, none of whom was able to prove any type of fraud. His case is one of the best, I think, in the world. And another case, guy, Thomas Carrington, I think that's his name, Carrington is his last name, was able to do that trick of finger levitation. You've heard of that, right, Therese?
Where's, no, I haven't.
That's where people, you get a group of people, four people, and someone sits in a chair, and the four people do this kind of rhythmic breathing, and then they kind of stick their fingers in the person's, under their knees and under their armpits, and lift them up. And supposedly they'll be really light. And it's a kid's game that a lot of people used to play. Finger levitation, it's called. Did an experiment with, and he put all these people on a giant scale, five people on a giant scale in a wooden chair. One guy sat in the chair, and the other four surrounded this one person. They did rhythmic breathing, and they lifted this person up with their fingertips. And sure enough, the person, they were able to lift him up, and this scientist recorded a loss of weight of 40 pounds on the first try. It was like 42 on the second, 41. It kind of stabilized in that area, but he did it over and over again and recorded this loss of weight. So there are other cases like that, other mediums like Rudi Schneider in Germany. He was able to levitate more than 20 times in front of large groups of scientists. And there are others. There are photographs, for goodness sake, which I put in the book, of people who have been able to capture this, you know, some really impressive ones. And it's been filmed as well, so.
We know that aspect. Wow. Excuse the interruption here. We know that aspect of that ability being possessed by a wide spectrum of the population is very, very intriguing.
Yeah.
I found your research very informative. Mm-hmm.
I don't think you have to be a yogi or, you know, a saint, because there's certainly a lot of, there's, of the 300-plus cases, 300 to 400 cases I found, a lot of them were saints and, you know, holy men and mystics and sorcerers and nuns and monks and things like this, right?
But right, 14th century, St. Catherine of Siena, yes. Mm-hmm.
But a lot were just children. There was a whole chapter I put on children. It's amazing. I think there's this floating stage between age 5 and, you know, 11 about, where kids have the ability, or are much more close to that ability to levitate or tap into it. They don't have the limits or some, but there are cases of housewives, of businessmen, of just normal people, farmers. So you don't have to be, you know, a saint to levitate, I guess is my point.
Very well said. I think of Padre Pio, too, from the 20th century. Oh, boy, can we turn now to ghost hunting?
Sure, yeah.
That's another. Oh, and on that levitation, I wanted to, let me see here. You have so many fine titles here. Now, the one on levitation is Human Levitation, A True History and How to Guide. And let me see, ghost hunting. Oh, boy. Let me see.
Yeah, I just had a book put out by Shipper Books, Ghosts of Greater Los Angeles.
Oh, I missed that. Tell me about that.
Yeah, that's, my 13th book, I think.
Yes. Yeah. You know what? I should correct that number on my site because I guess it was at least 11. I'll make 13. I'm sorry. Please pardon me.
Yeah, you may now, have. I forgot about that.
Well, you know, I want to hear about it. I want to hear very much about Los Angeles. I also, on a somber note, was checking out the California Ghost True Accounts of Hauntings in the Golden State. I'm not sure if this vignette was there, but you were mentioning that with Charles Manson, the sites of his horrific crimes later became infested, the homes became infested by a negative presence. That was very interesting. And the presence itself was removed only after the residence was dismantled and a new home was raised and a new home was constructed at the site.
Right. Absolutely left a trail of darkness. And I talked to first-hand witnesses who experienced this supernatural activity, and later got confirmation as well from another person. Absolutely, yeah. In one house, the witness I talked to said she walked through it. This was the house, I think, where Sharon Tate was murdered.
Tate, mm-hmm.
And which was, I believe, burned down or was raised. At any rate, she walked in and she wanted to use the bathroom. And the guy's like, oh, yeah, use the one upstairs. So they're walking through the house, and none of the lights would work. They could not get any of the lights to work. Because, they knew what kind of house this was. And like, that's weird. I wonder if there's a problem with the electricity. But they walked into the bathroom, or she, this one lady, she said it was just filled with flies. Now, this is a very rare manifestation, and as soon as, Loretta Lynn has a haunted mansion, or a haunted plantation, I believe. And she has this same thing happening in one of her rooms. Just hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of flies. She ran back into the, first floor screaming, and she complained to the owner, and he's like, oh yeah, I have a problem with that room. And he was able to turn on all the lights, by the way. He would walk in, and he's like, no, there's no problem with the lights. And he walked to each room, and he flipped on the light switch, and it worked fine. Worked fine for him. So that was just one of the houses, too. There was another house up Old Topanga Canyon who I talked to, a couple of witnesses who said that there was activity there. One lady, she was a real estate agent, and she was trying to sell the house, and was just having the devil of a time trying to sell it, if you'll forgive the pun. And
right.
So, she finally was another lady wanted to see it, and she said this lady was your typical, fortune teller type, with the wearing a muumuu and lots of beads and jewelry and rings, and walked into this house and said, oh my goodness, there's a dark energy here. A very bad crime's been committed here. Someone was killed here, and sacrifice and things like this. And she was just laying out the whole crime as if she was an investigator. And the real estate agent was stunned, of course, because she knew what the house was. And at that time, there was no disclosure laws.
Disclosure requirement.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Now, even if your house is haunted, in some states you have to disclose that because people are sued. And crimes can leave a trail of hauntings. And in fact, I've talked to, you have to be careful when it comes to ghosts. Some of the people I've interviewed had really bad hauntings, which were not fun experiences for them, and almost ended up in possession, honestly. And and they started out with using a Ouija board. Now, I have used a Ouija board on a couple of occasions at least, with a professional medium, though. And we did table lifting. Actually, she was a physical medium, and she could lift this table up. It was amazing. But for the most part, I would not recommend people to mess around with a Ouija board. But, on the other hand, ghosts are not as dangerous as a lot of people think. For the most part, it's a big deal for a ghost to move an object or make a knocking noise or, make an object disappear. And for the most part, they are just people who are, either tied to the house or related to us. A lot of the ghosts that people see are, spirits of deceased loved ones or people they know. So that is definitely something to consider, I think, when it comes to ghosts. But, yeah, there's a danger there. I think you should treat them like people. Some people are dangerous. We all know that. And a person has to be careful. But for the most part, they're just people.
Very intriguing comments. I found, now I want to note your two books, highly recommended, California Ghosts, True Accounts of Hauntings in the Golden State, also Supernatural California, A Golden State Guide. Now you have a latest work on ghosts in Los Angeles. And this is rather a basic a question. On ghost hunting, Preston, do you find the majority of the apparitions or of actual spirits are seeking actual interaction versus the type of, let's say, historic repetition of an event? A repetition of a historic event?
Right. that's one of the explanations for ghosts.
Or any master.
And we know that that is true in some cases because there are haunting locations. Like, and a typical example would be, you know, the Civil War ghosts in some of these southern states, which have been pretty well verified and caught on video even. And so that's your type of time stamp or residual haunting is what the technical term is. That's often used.
Thank you. I was looking for that. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And in that case, you can tell because it's the ghost does not react to you. The ghost is not aware of you. It seems to be part of the environment. Whereas a ghost or a spirit, as opposed to a residual haunting, does interact with you. And so I think it's important to differentiate. And so when you can walk into a school, some, you know, places that are occupied often, and you'll have residual hauntings of, you know, you can hear laughter, or in theaters, lots of theaters are haunted, and you can hear voices. And this is not at all uncommon. And in fact, I caught it on the Queen Mary, and they recorded voices. Mm-hmm. So those are residual hauntings often, whereas a spirit will be someone you'll know because they're trying to get your attention. They're turning on lights, they're taking your shoes, or they make the toilet flush. I had one haunting I investigated, which I wrote about in this book, Greater Ghosts of Los Angeles. And this is a private haunting. This is at someone's home. And their problem, their ghost kept locking doors. And not locking, but making doors unable to be opened. And it was the most bizarre thing because these doors weren't locked. And it got to be such a problem, they had a door that had no latch. It was just a swinging door. And still, it would become locked. They would have to take it off the hinges or break the window. And once their freezer, their freezer doors, they couldn't open it for 3 days. They tried everything. And then pops open. And they knew it was related to this ghost because all their other doors were having this problem. It wasn't settling of the house. You know, they had a lot of activity in this particular house. It wasn't just doors. But I just thought it was an interesting manifestation because you get so many different types of manifestations. Odors. They had perfume going through the house. So, very interesting. Ghosts are trying to be noticed.
Yes, the uniqueness and almost the insistence that they be noticed. You know, this seems a perfect time to ask this question. Again, it's from an ICAR researcher. I believe he wishes to remain rather anonymous. Preston, he wonders, now that you've covered several areas within the paranormal, is there anything else you want to tackle that interests you, paranormal or otherwise, that you haven't opened up with a can opener yet?
Yeah, I have done a lot of different, you know, one of the latest ones that I did a bunch of research on was for one of my books, Supernatural California, and I looked into the whole Bigfoot thing, and boy, I resisted that one for as long as I could, because that just seemed like a can of worms to me, and I frankly was a little skeptical, but after doing the research just for the California cases, Bigfoot is real, I have no doubt about it, the evidence for Bigfoot, Sasquatch, the Skunk Ape. Again, this is something that's in all different cultures, stretching back through history for thousands of years. So this is not even a new thing. And, with the Bigfoot cases, I'm not going to say thousands, but certainly with over 100, and 200 even. But, the evidence for Bigfoot, that's something. What else? Gosh.
That is an intriguing subject. There's one question here I've missed from the room. Preston, pardon the interruption. But it's an interesting question. Now, it was asked by Nora's boy. He wonders if the ashes of the deceased can be detected as well as spiritual entities.
The ashes of the deceased?
Yes. Perhaps in a room respectfully stored in a container. Would that have any type of... alert the psychic, alert the impressions.
Certainly, I think it's going to have vibrations around it, and you could, if you were psychic, you could probably do what's called psychometry, which is basically, you know, getting in touch with the energy of an object and being able to tell that object's history. So absolutely, I think it would aid in, you know, being connected to that person in some way. But on the other hand, a person, when they die, I think that they realize pretty quick that they are not their physical body.
Yes.
And while they may certainly be aware to it, and in some cases even tied to it for a little while at least, and certainly that's not unusual. You know, people will, you know, feel that loss of the physical body, but at some point, I think they realize that that's not who they truly are, and they leave that all that behind. And you can get in touch with the person anyway. In fact, this is one of the best ways to have an out-of-body experience is a connection with a deceased person.
Mm-hmm.
And they will take you to the other side and give you a tour if you can really just focus all your meditation onto them each night for a couple of nights, three nights, four, whatever it takes. Do it, and that person will come to you. Absolutely.
Well, now, Preston, we have about 1 minute left here. I want to thank you so much for this interview. I've learned a great deal during this program. I hope you'll keep us updated on all the latest developments, including your latest book that you say is now just being published regarding ghosts in L.A. Now, your website can be found at home.pacbell.net/Prestone. Thank you so much, Preston. I've really enjoyed this time.
Oh, thank you.
Appreciate it.
I really had a great time, too. I love doing your show. It's always a lot of fun. And thank you, actually. I love having the opportunity to do this.
Thank you again, sir. It was an honor to have you as a guest. And I hope everyone has a great weekend. And next week, our guest will be George Lobono, author of Alien Mind, The Thought and Behavior of Extraterrestrials. Preston, thank you again. Very informative. Wonderful weekend, everyone.
Thanks, Trace. Bye.